And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. The war on workers continues. The backroom wheeling and dealing in full arm twist and pocket lining mode as the moneyed interests fill the campaign coffers, fill the trough. It's really kind of a stampede as the GOP is burying their trunks deep in the trough. Fill those coffers, man. Got to get all you can. Hooray for me! I understand the Republicans are thinking of adding a couple more voting days in February so that they can push all their poison. We'll talk about that. On the federal level, internet payola may be in our near future with the most recent appeals court decision basically ending net neutrality. And my wife and I had this conversation today because she immediately figured it out. And I just said, well, you know, this is what happened. And she goes, so basically, anything that I'm looking for, I'm going to struggle to find. And what they want me to see will be there front and center and very quickly. And I said, yeah, you know, when you look for your scrapbooking stuff, the company that's kicking some money to Comcast or Verizon, that's the stuff you'll see first. Kind of like Google does. You know, when you search for something, there are a couple of things right there at the top that are the preferred, or I forget what the word they use, because I don't even look at the first ones. If they're up there, I don't even look at it. But, you know, this is where we're heading. And we've known for a while this is where it's heading. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Also, we're told the Wall Street-funded right-to-work legislation is the utopian paradise for workers. Lose your rights to collective bargaining, give up your voice on the job, and the benevolent employer will bestow rivers of gold and honey on you. Well, we're going to see how things have been working out in Michigan since Michigan became the latest victim to fall prey to the Wall Street venom. We'll talk about that. Also today, Martin Luther King Jr. was born back in 1929. Maybe we'll look at his book, All Labor Has Dignity. This idea that we should actually be able to have some dignity and self-respect based on what we do. Wow, it's pretty amazing stuff. I'll also take your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind tonight, whatever's on the page. We will get to 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The year was 1919, yes. The great Boston molasses tragedy, or the great molasses flood, or the Boston molasses disaster, as it became known. Whatever it was, whatever name you want to give it, there was a company that stored large amounts of molasses, a huge storage tank on the north end of Boston. On this day, explosion, the molasses, imagine a 40-foot high wave of molasses barreling down your street at 35 miles an hour. Imagine, I mean, just try and get molasses to get out of a jar. And, you know, they don't say slower than molasses for nothing, because it's, but imagine this stuff coming at you at 35 miles an hour, a 40-foot tsunami of it. Well, on this day, you had 21 people who lost their lives and 150 more who were injured. And you go back and you got to wonder, did we have regulations? What's interesting is some people still to this day, nearly 100 years later, say that, you know, 95 years later, say that, well, you can still smell the molasses on a hot day. I mean, imagine that, a 40-foot tsunami wall of molasses. And you go back and you go, we have these tragedies, we have these spills, these contaminations, whatever you want to call it, we have these fairly often. I mean, every so often this happens. And, you know, you get the John Boehner mentality. Oh, well, we've got enough regulations. But yet, you know, you look at what happened in West Virginia. And over on my Facebook page, you know, someone had put out a picture of a bathtub of this stew, this yellow water. And, you know, on the Facebook page, you said, you know, this is what freedom looks like. This is, you know, freedom water. There it is, right there. This wonderful yellow liquid. And as I said, you know, the Nothing says freedom like being doused in a yellow liquid. This golden delight. Now, the question is, what happens out of this? You know, where do we go? And are we asking questions about our own neighborhoods? Understand, in West Virginia, you're talking about this one spill contaminated somewhere between 16 and 18% of all of the potable water in the state of West Virginia. Now, think about as that water moves downriver to Ohio or to Kentucky, as it continues, is that water contaminated? Does it contaminate, does it harm the people there as well? Because I had someone email me and say, well, the state of West Virginia, if they don't want to regulate it, they don't have to. And I go, no, it's not entirely accurate. Because I think there are some interests in Ohio that may go, hey, I don't think we want your trash coming to us. And I think Kentucky has kind of the same right. We don't want your freedom water. We just want our water. And, you know, I love the Boehner position that, you know, we don't need any more regulations. Someone should be held accountable because they weren't inspected from us since 1991. Now, these are the very people who say we shouldn't be doing all this stuff. We need to deregulate, and regulations are job killers. So I've been wondering, how long is it going to take before people in my neighborhood, maybe your neighborhood, people across the country start going, hey, what's on the other side of that fence? Do we know what they're doing over there? And the question comes back, do we have a right to that? Do you have a right to know what these companies are doing right in our backyards? And not just here, but across the country. What they do to our air, what they do to our land, what they do to our water. Do we have a right to know? Because understand, here in Pennsylvania, with all the fracking going on, there's a lot of people saying, hey, we should know what's going on, and our water should be tested more often. But there are those who say, no, you don't have that right. And we don't need more regulations. Bill Hetzel, he's a reporter of a public source, and we're going to talk to him tomorrow about this piece that he wrote on the ammonium. Ammonium nitrate. He claims that there are 1.5 million people here in Pennsylvania that live close enough to large, hazardous amounts of ammonia. And, you know, what ammonia is, especially the refrigerant stuff. Now, I remember when I lived in Allentown, my ex-wife had worked at the Kraft food plant, and they had this pipe that was probably 3.5-4 foot around. It was this massive pipe. And through the middle of this pipe, you had anhydrous ammonia. And huge amounts of it, because it's a coolant. I mean, it's the same refrigerant, I think, that Honda uses in their cars. And I think some other cars now do, too. But you have this anhydrous ammonia that is, well, just, it's horrible. I mean, it's horrible stuff. If you breathe it in, it will kill you. Really, I mean, especially in large amounts. And, you know, a little bit, you know, you're talking, you know, burning the skin, burning the eyes, cause blindness, stuff like that. A large amount of it, done. Because anhydrous means without water. It basically sucks all the water out of you. Which is why they had a spill, I think it was somewhere in either in western or western southern Ohio. And as it got out, because it lays along the grass, because it's heavier than air, so it laid on the ground, and all the cows were dead. This is nasty stuff. Well, this guy says, you know, one out of every 8 people in this commonwealth lives close enough to facilities that store large amounts of this ammonia, that a risk, you know, of a release could be catastrophic. And, you know, I'm waiting for the next series. You know, what other chemicals, what other stuff is out there? They claim the 1.5 million numbers are just, you know, just broad numbers. People's houses are around these facilities. It doesn't include, you know, people gathering at schools or at malls, or it doesn't even include the workers at the facilities But you know, you've got these huge facilities, and there are 122 facilities here in Pennsylvania that store at least 5 tons of this ammonia. And you know, these are huge companies. I mean, U.S. Steel, Giant, Giant Eagle, Walmart, Cisco, Tyson Foods, Hershey, Yingling. A number of these big companies have these huge storage facilities. And what gets me is, as this guy did this reporting, they're claiming this is the first time that they've compiled this data to see, you know, where these places are, where you may live. And it's over at Penn Live. I picked up the article, and they have a map there where you can see where all, and I went and looked, where all of these facilities are, how close you are, and what the downwind dangers are. So I suggest taking a look at it. But what's interesting to me is none of our regulators, our government, our local people never really said, hey, you know, we should let the public know the risks of what's in the neighborhood. We should be letting people know what's going on in their backyard. You know, and in this article, they talk about the Hershey Creamery, the ice cream, not the candy people, but the ice cream people, and the amount of this stuff, that this ammonium that they have on site. And you know, they go through their history with OSHA, and I guess they were fined $100,000 back in 2004. And there, you know, there's a whole bunch of this stuff where you just go, this is why we need regulations. Now, understand, according to the article, between 1996 and 2011, you had more than 900 accidents just with this one chemical. Killed 19 people, injured more than 1,600 nationwide, according to this report. Here in Pennsylvania, from that time period, you had 18 of these accidents. No one killed, 27 people injured. So, you know, you go, it's not a big problem, it's not a huge problem, unless you're one of the people who got killed in it. And they talk about this one story. A woman evidently had driven through an area where there was a release, and it actually conked out her car. That actually stalled her car. It just evaporated, you know, everything. And she stalled in the middle of it. And, well, you know, they found her body about 10 feet away from the car because she couldn't get away from it. What I found interesting about the article, though, is they called the vice president of the Hershey Creamery and asked him for a comment. And, you know, asked, you know, about their risk management contacts and what the safety procedures were. And the guy just said, look it up on the Internet, and hung up on him. This is why you need to have, really honestly and truthfully, this is why you need to have regulators. You need to have people with the power to step in and say, we demand to know. And while these tragedies, they do happen, I believe they can be prevented. And I think the reporting should happen a whole lot quicker. Just my thoughts. But I suggest take a look at it. We'll get a link up on the website to the Penn Live article. I think it's worth the time. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. And listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Come from the cities and they come from the smaller towns. Beat up cars with guitars and drummers.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Infrastructure investment and jobs will be high priorities for the AFL-CIO in 2014. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the U.S. has a $3.6 trillion infrastructure deficit. The amount of money needed to adequately repair, restore, and upgrade America's infrastructure to remain globally competitive.
What would work best to grow our economy is a comprehensive strategy to invest in infrastructure and energy innovation. innovation. And I'm talking about measuring our investment in trillions with a T, a big investment to create jobs and spur our economy.
Crumkin says he'll be listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech to judge the commitment to domestic policies that will help working people.
To make meaningful gains possible in the lives of typical working families. I want to hear about increases in the minimum wage, proposals for sick leave to help families and other measures to boost living standards, to help rebuild a strong middle class, and to stop the collapse of wages for working families.
Trumka says we can't let the ideological opposition of some Republicans derail public infrastructure investments. The AFL-CIO will try to partner with groups like the Chamber of Commerce to get infrastructure investments that would create badly needed jobs.
The Chamber and the AFL-CIO agree that the country's atrophying, that we need to meet the deficit that the Society of Civil Engineers places at $3.6 trillion. If you care about this country, if you care about the competitiveness of this country, we can't allow ideology to stop us from doing what's necessary to keep the American economy competitive and keep people working.
A new five-year national contract will be implemented for 13,000 UPS freight workers represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The workers voted overwhelmingly to approve the contract. It includes a $2.50 per hour raise over the five-year deal, making Teamster UPS workers the highest paid in the industry, according to the union. The union says the new contract also improves and protects pension benefits, lowers health insurance co-pays while maintaining strong benefits, provides the ability for more part-time workers to become full-time, and lowers the monthly cost for retiree health insurance. Every day that Republicans in Congress refuse to act to extend unemployment benefits, millions of dollars are lost to the economy, and long-term jobless workers grow increasingly desperate. Maura Stamper of Southgate, Michigan, was forced off unemployment benefits just before Christmas.
And if I wasn't married, I'd be on the street. I know there's lots of people that are on the street. And if this continues, we could very well lose our house that we've been in for 25 years. I just don't know how much more I can stress that we need these benefits. We need these benefits to survive, not to get rich, just to survive.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And by the way, what we shouldn't do, I just got to say this, what we shouldn't be doing is trying to take away your rights to bargain for better wages or working conditions.
Things we've been talking about all week now as the Republicans are back, as the legislature's back in session, and the Republicans are setting their priorities. And the way it appears, the priorities are, hey, let's go after those state workers and let's stick it to those state workers, those unions. Before Christmas, I got this press release. It was put out by the Secretary of Administration, a woman named Kelly Powell Logan, praising the state employees. In fact, the press release read, state employees have pledged nearly $3 million to more than 1,000 charitable organizations through the annual State Employee Combined Appeal Campaign. Kelly Powell Logan says the holiday season is time for helping others, and we are incredibly proud of the generous and caring shown by our state employees. The millions of dollars raised will benefit hundreds of worthy causes both here in Pennsylvania and throughout the world. And now what they're saying, hey, thanks for your money. In fact, you know, we're taking it through payroll deduction, but we're not going to allow you. Well, we're not going to allow you to have payroll deduction for your union dues. Seems to be kind of, because it's too expensive, right? Way too expensive. But for these 1,000 other things, no, too expensive there. Just seems to me, again, as I've been saying all week, it's political payback. that simple, which is why we've asked our good friend Attorney Irwin Aronson to come talk to us about House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick.
So we have these extraordinarily charitable state employees who have, of their frozen wages and their wages that haven't been going up over the last several years, have donated nearly $3 million to 1,000 charitable causes. And now what we see, the arrows are turned against them.
What a surprise. The only thing you leave out there is the Corbett administration is somehow attempting to take credit for the dedicated and philanthropic actions and conduct of our Pennsylvania state workers, as if they had something to do with it. But you're right on beat. There are any number of deductions from public employee paychecks, and private employee paychecks for that matter, dues being among them for their unions when they freely choose to join a union, but only after their union on their behalf and their employer have agreed through collective bargaining that a dues checkoff is among the things that should be in a collectively bargained agreement. The wingnuts who are pursuing this political payback, as you so aptly put it, seem to forget or intentionally mislead their audiences into thinking that the law requires a checkoff. It doesn't. The law requires union dues deduction. It doesn't. What the law requires is that the government as a law stay out of the process of collective bargaining and let the collective bargaining partners work things out. If you strip public sector employers of their right to bargain over these things, you've taken a bargaining chip away from them, and that means that something else will have to give. This is always the product of collective bargaining, and it continues to shock me how these people who keep on telling us they want government off our backs want to stick government regulation into this process.
And the people who are against regulation. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. Not only are they against government in our lives, but also against regulation. So, I mean, here you've got both ends of this.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, not only do we have both ends of this, but the people who are promoting it, the people who are advocating it, the people who are telling the lies and making up the songs and the stories about how this is somehow costing state and local government and school districts money, another big lie, and we'll get back to that, are hiding, of course, their own contributions, billions and billions and billions of dollars that they pass off onto all manner of hocus-pocus, untraceable corporate structures and phony baloney social welfare organizations that get a special tax exemption from the Internal Revenue Service and then complain when the Internal Revenue Service has the temerity to ask questions about the bona fides of this so-called social welfare organization. And when they're not doing that, they're passing their money off to the Commonwealth Foundation that creates phony studies under the guise of some academic veil, as you were. But when asked the Commonwealth Foundation where their money comes from, they, of course, won't tell anybody. They have to hide that, even though we're sure that it's coming from the likes of the Koch brothers and other lunatic fringe right-wing people who are using their billions to strip basic rights from working men and women and to hammer down the middle class, beat it into submission.
And they come up with some of the nicest names, Irwin, like this, you know, the ALEC legislation that is House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. I've heard dubbed as paycheck protection. In fact, had a couple of listeners who sent me, you know, emails saying, hey, I'm in favor of people protecting my paycheck. I want to make sure my wages aren't stolen. I want to make sure everything is as it should be. Do these laws do anything to actually protect my paycheck rather than just give me some soft verbiage?
Anything but. This is another one of these silly, ridiculous, misdirected, thinly veiled characterization. It should be called what it is. It's paycheck deception, Nick. They're trying to deceive people into thinking they're protecting their paychecks, but what they're doing really is protecting the paychecks that are not paychecks, but wheelbarrows full of money that they're stealing from working men and women. And they want to make sure that working men and women don't have a voice at work. And you do so by bludgeoning their labor organizations, their freely chosen labor organizations, their labor organizations that have democratic elections internally to select who their leaders and voices will be, unlike the Koch brothers who designate themselves through their multi-billions and billions. And there's no protection in this for working people. There's deception. And just like right to work is a phony statement, and the people who advocate it are afraid to call it what it is. They fear it so that they have to make up new lines and new stories and mischaracterizations. So too these people who have chosen through colossal gall, Rick, to refer to this as paycheck protection. It is anything but. And nobody's paycheck is protected by what it says, and everybody's paycheck is placed at risk if it ever passes.
You know, the thing is we're stuck in this Orwellian world of doublespeak. I mean, we both know it's not paycheck protection, and I think all of our listeners know that as well as right to work. They push this idea, and, you know, like, I run these ideas past my wife because she really doesn't know a lot of this and doesn't really want to. So it's a good filter. I say, you know, what do you think of this? She goes, I think everyone should have the right to work. Is that what this is? Do you actually get any rights out of it? Is there any work out of it? And, well, no, but it sounds nice.
Well, as we've talked about before, the litmus test, if you will, the true litmus test for people is when they so detest their own ideas that they themselves have to spend more time and more effort in making up a phony descriptor for what they're doing than they do in pushing the ideas. We are trading in a world of ideas, and they're afraid of their own ideas, so they have to call it right to work, and they have to call it paycheck protection, instead of calling it what it is, stripping people of their rights, deceiving people about their paycheck. Any time somebody who is not a working person or an advocate of working people, selected by working people to be their advocate, decides to announce to the world that he or she is going to protect working people, the first thing workers should do is grab onto their wallets and their checkbooks, because that's what's at risk of you.
Absolutely.
And right after that immediate risk, their futures are at stake. Their houses are at stake. Their automobiles are at stake. Most significantly, their children's future, Rick, is at stake. And every time these outsiders swoop in on our state, come in from out of nowhere with no support locally, with no local backing, with no local funding, and all of a sudden decide what our agenda should be when unemployed people have given up and aren't looking for work any longer because there are no jobs in the Corbett economy, when people are scared of drinking their water and breathing their air, when schools are being closed, when teachers who train our children for a future are being laid off, when our streets are crumbling, when our bridges are falling, when children are not getting the nourishment they need to be able to learn, and we all of a sudden find that the priority is not addressing any one of those or hundreds more critical, immediate issues for the people that people need their government to help them with, but instead we have a full-court press spending tens of millions of dollars to pass a paycheck deception law in Pennsylvania. We know that something is amiss, and we Pennsylvanians know these outsiders. We know these carpetbaggers. We know these corporate bums who are trying to impose their view of the world on our little place in the sun. And we are going to expose them. We must call them out. We need to tell people what they are, who they are, what they're doing. And we need to do it every day, day in and day out, and take it to every single member of the Pennsylvania General Assembly, all 251 at present members of the Pennsylvania House and Senate, and let them know in their homes, in their backyards, where their children go to school, where their parents are living in nursing homes, what this means. Not to somebody in Denver, Colorado, not to somebody with a big ski chalet in Vail or Aspen, but what it means in Williamsport, what it means in Cowdersport, and what it means in Chambersburg, what it means in Radnor, and what it means in Butler, what it means up in Edinburgh, and what it means down in Upper Darby. That's the deal. That's the real deal. And unfortunately, when the big money lying liars come into town, we need to roll up our sleeves and get to work, and that's exactly what we're all doing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. A moment ago you brought up the Commonwealth Foundation, who I call the Tea Party think tank. And the money, as you pointed out, we don't get to know who funds this, where it's coming from. I think everyone knows it's Wall Street. It's the billionaire class that we've created. But what's interesting about it, now what I think most people don't really get is, you know, they live in their own little incestuous world where they produce all of these papers that they start with the conclusion and then work their way backwards, and then they end up citing each other to get the words that they want and the findings that they want. When you look at places like Michigan and Indiana, I've been reading stuff all day where they're saying it is economic paradise in those places that pass this nonsensical right to work. Wisconsin is a utopian paradise for workers now because wages are going up. But when you look at actual fact, It's the exact opposite. It just seems to me that we've fallen down the rabbit hole in our media structure.
Well, we've not only fallen down the rabbit hole in our media structure, but it is literally shocking my conscience that we don't have anybody in the regular press corps that is calling out the Commonwealth Foundation, for example, raising questions, asking the question every time the Commonwealth Foundation has yet another of its phony baloney press conferences, backing up one of its questionable, at best, studies, where the funding from the study came from, who's sponsoring this, but also not asking the question of when did the Commonwealth Foundation, a so-called intellectual think tank, morph into an appropriate lobbying organization because they're at the Capitol advocating the passage and defeat of laws, and that, it seems to me, is a grand and huge deviation from what their tax-exempt status grants unto them under our laws. And remember, every one of the dollars that they collect from these Wall Street raiders and every one of the dollars that the Commonwealth Foundation collects from the ilk of the Koch brothers is a tax deduction, which means that your taxes and my taxes and the taxes of every one of our listeners goes up to fund what taxes are not being paid because of these contributions to the people that are trying to steal our paycheck.
It's infuriating.
There is something fundamentally wrong.
I'm with you, and it's infuriating on so many levels. And, you know, you look at this and you ask the question, what should we be doing? I mean, I had this conversation earlier today where someone said, you know, I'm just one guy, but I want to go to the streets and scream. And I said, yes, that's what we should be doing.
Well, I think that we should go to the streets and scream. I don't think there's any question about that. But more significantly, I think that virtually all, if not all of our listeners, have access to telephones, have access to email. And now is the time to call their state House members and their state senators and point blank say, I live in your district. I vote in your district. My spouse votes in your district. My mom votes in your district. My cousins vote in your district. We've lived here all of our lives. We've raised our children here. We've built our homes here. We've supported our local grocer and our local car dealer here. And now we're asking you to support us and to reject these outsiders coming in and trying to impose their outside values on our Pennsylvania. And if you don't do what we ask, we're going to remember you're going to be circulating, Mr. Representative, Madam Senator, you're going to be circulating nominating petitions in just a few weeks to get reelected to the seat that you hold that's paid for by us taxpayers to be our representative. And you need to know that we're watching and that if you don't represent us in Harrisburg, we're going to vote in our primary in May. We're going to vote in our general election in November. And we're going to show you what we think, and we're capable of doing it. We may not have tens of millions of dollars, but we have something that in Pennsylvania that Koch brothers do not have in Pennsylvania. We each have our right to vote. And I know that that's under assault by these ALEC bums as well. That's what voter ID was, and we talked about that on this show in the past. But with or without voter ID, we have our right to vote, and we're going to exercise our right to vote. Every single member of the Pennsylvania General Assembly, Democrat or Republican, Senator or House member, urban or rural, black, white, green, male, female, doesn't matter. Every single one of them needs to know that we're watching. And if they vote to support paycheck deception, if they refuse to stand up and defeat this ill-conceived radical proposal to strip people of their right to freely bargain and negotiate contracts, that we will be watching and we will be voting and we will vote again and again, and our memories are long.
Now, here's another part of this that's really infuriating. There are so many other things that need to be done. There are so many things that I talk to people all the time. Why haven't we taken the Medicaid expansion money? Why aren't we investing in education? Why aren't we investing in upgrading our technology, broadband access? Why aren't we doing these other things? Why is it that we're stuck in these really heavily divisive issues that the vast majority of the people, one, don't really understand and don't really care about?
Well, and that was the point I was trying to make earlier, far less artfully than you have just made it now. We have needs, and there are needs that we uniquely depend upon our government to handle. And our government is being diverted now by these outside interests that are swooping in here, as I've said, and trying to set the agenda so that members of the General Assembly, instead of addressing these critical issues that you so clearly articulate, are dealing with this junk and trying to fill the heads of the public with some silly story about how all the ills of society will be corrected if we only pass a law that prohibits workers and employers from freely negotiating the terms of what will happen at the workplace.
And I understand there's a press conference going to happen on January 28th, 10 a.m. At the Capitol Rotunda. That's a Tuesday, January 28th, 10 a.m. at the Capitol Rotunda. To highlight this to the folks in our halls of power, but for me also, hopefully, to bring people out and do some of that in the street stuff.
Well, look, there is indeed going to be a press conference, and that's what it is, a press conference. It's not a rally. We're not anticipating or looking for big crowds, but we are anticipating to shine a light under the Capitol dome about this issue. But even more significant, I am confident that this weekend and every day leading up to whatever action is ultimately taken on this paycheck deception legislative proposal, working people, men and women and their children, college students, teachers, plumbers, pipe fitters, electricians, roofers, tile setters, bricklayers, carpenters, steam fitters, you name it, steel workers, machinists, public sector workers, as well as private sector workers, are going to be calling, emailing, and visiting members of the General Assembly and letting them know how working people feel about this proposed governmental intrusion into the free process of collective bargaining and how it is such a phony red herring issue when there's so much that needs to be done, when there are so many things that our government could do to make life a little easier, or to simply recognize that in a post-industrial economy that they've allowed to be imposed on us because of things like NAFTA, now TAP, and other phony trade legislation, we are not producing enough jobs to support Pennsylvania families, and the action that we need is jobs legislation. The action that we need is to force the Congress into dealing with the extension of unemployment insurance benefits. The action we need is for Governor Corbett to finally recognize that the government of the United States is willing to give Pennsylvania hundreds of millions of dollars in order to assure that poor people have access to health care in this state. That we need to talk about the real issues, not these scam issues. And make no mistake about it, Rick, this paycheck deception legislation is nothing more than a high-tech scam being perpetrated on the people of Pennsylvania. And some of the media are, you're right, giving them a pass because they got lazy and they're not asking the questions, or maybe it's because some of the mainstream media is just itself populated with a bunch of employers who have confused their editorial and free press obligations with their desire to make ever more money, even when it's at the expense of the very people who have to buy the newspapers and watch TV stations and listen to the radio stations that they own.
Well, call it whatever you want, paycheck deception, paycheck destruction, as well as paycheck distraction. To me, this is a distraction from all of another distraction away from things that Corbett and these Republicans should have been doing for the last couple of years, and they've failed on those points. So to me, this is some busy work. It's vitally dangerous. It's something that has to be fought, but it looks to me like it's busy work so that they can change the message.
Well, it's certainly a very high-level tactic aimed at diverting the people from the real issues. But you've identified the real issues on this show. I've attempted to identify some of those real issues in our conversation this evening. Our listeners know the real issues. The people of Pennsylvania know the real issues.
Yeah.
The reason that all of these right-wing outsiders need to come in here with tens of millions of dollars is because they want to keep us from addressing those issues. They want to tell us that that's not the problem. This is like telling somebody with dentures that they need Pepsodent. But give us all a break here.
Yeah.
Okay? We know what we need, and to the degree that the mainstream media is going to evade or avoid their responsibility, we will make the world responsible. We will tell the story. We will get out on the street. We will talk to our members. We will talk to people in the neighborhood and in our neighborhoods in allied groups. This is not just a union issue by any stretch of the imagination.
And we
this is an issue about what the quality of life for people in Pennsylvania will be moving forward.
And we will continue to follow up on this as it continues down the road. The hope is that this gets quashed and we move on to some really very important issues other than this Machiavellian payback by our friends in the Republican Party. Irwin, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
I'll be there. Good to hear you and good to be on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In the ever-escalating competition to be the number one big-time college football program in the nation, Ohio State University bulked up last fall with a monster recruit named Max. Actually, it's not the coaching staff that signed up this brute, but the OSU campus police department. And the recruit's full name is Max Pro, not a football player, but a 19-ton armored fighting vehicle built by a Pentagon contractor to withstand, quote, ballistic arms fire, minefields, IEDs, and nuclear, biological, and chemical environments. Wow, college games really have gotten rough. But the campus PD, which received the Max Pro as a gift from the Pentagon, i.e. us taxpayers, says it's not just playing games. Max is available for big actions, like hostage scenarios, killers loose on campus, and extreme flooding of up to 3 feet. Well, have such things been a problem at OSU? No. Would a huge, slow, gas-guzzling vehicle designed for warfare be effective if any of the above were actually to occur? No one in the department wanted to tackle that question. Oh, by the way, operating and maintaining these machines requires specially trained and licensed personnel. Are any of OSU's officers qualified? Again, no answer from headquarters. Also, the vehicles are subject to frequent rollovers, and they lack the ability to go off-road or to maneuver in confined areas. That doesn't sound ideal for a college campus. But the gendarmes say they've adjusted Max to fit their needs. How? By removing the gun turret and repainting the vehicle. This is Jim Hightower saying, OSU police finally admitted that Max's chief role would be to provide a police presence on football game days. Great. Police authorities now believe they need a show of military force to keep tailgaters in check.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, here's the other part of this. Once they, this is one of those moments of the death of a thousand paper cuts. I got an email during the break of someone saying, you know what, I don't know why you're spending so much time. It doesn't affect me. And I think we've gotten into this silo mentality where if we cannot connect the dots directly to us in something, and this is a societal thing, I think. That if we cannot connect it to how it affects us or someone that we know immediately, then it's not important. Understand that once we used to understand in this country at a certain point that if we allow someone to be harmed, all of us were harmed. If there was an injury to one, there was an injury to all. If we allowed someone in our community to go hungry or homeless, it was a reflection on all of us. And we worked to stop that. So now what the right has done masterfully, and really for the last 30 years, if you go back and you really plot out how they've gotten us to this point, to where, you know, our heads are down on the treadmill, we're just, you know, running like little rats trying to get the cheese. And you never get there. And they use, oh, you're talking about, you're a communist or socialist. No, you're just talking about being a decent member of your community. And making sure that people have the right and the ability to stand up. This paycheck destruction bill, call it what you want. Paycheck destruction, deception, distraction, whatever. It's not paycheck protection. Understand that from the get-go. There's no protection here. It's like right to work. There's no right. There's no work. But what it is it's that little, it's a little cut. Okay, we harmed these people. We silenced this group. Who's the next group? And the next group, and the next group. Until eventually everyone's silent. Except the people who have control. And I look to Wisconsin, because, you know, I take all of this back to Wisconsin. Because, you know, when we were in Wisconsin back in 2011, when a lot of this ugliness really came to the forefront. Understand, the ugliness had always been there. All of these wish lists, we're going to make everybody a right-to-work state, we're going to go do all of these things to silence people's ability to bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions. It's always been there. These think tanks have always wanted it. The wealth classes always wanted this power. But I think we were just smart enough to say no. We're not even going to consider it. Well, 3 years ago in Wisconsin, when they rammed it through over the objections of a good majority in Wisconsin, they rammed it through like thieves in the night. I remember it was like 2 o'clock in the morning when we were there, and people were all enraged, as they, you know, like I said, like thieves in the night. We were there to say, hey, look, this is a national strategy. This is, the playbook is going to be passed around. Eventually it's going to come to Pennsylvania. We need to be activated. We need to be educated. We need to get informed and make sure it doesn't come here and stop it. Well, the moneyed interests have said, well, you know what? We made it through Ohio and Indiana and Michigan and Wisconsin and Tennessee and Oklahoma and all of these states across the country. They've gone in, blown a bunch of money, and then moved along. And here they are. And they've set up these little fake think tanks, like the Tinky Tank there at the Commonwealth Foundation. And, you know, they start with their conclusion, which is if we pass these insane laws, things will get better. So then they find little sectors that actually got better, not because of what they passed, but because it was going to happen anyway, and they exploit that. And then all of this whole network, because this is a huge network, all of these networks then cite each other. It's this incestuous little relationship of right-wing idiocy. But what they are is extraordinarily well-funded. And then they get onto their talk radio monopoly, and they just pound it out. You know, and as I've been saying these last couple of weeks, you know, it's rare that I don't run into somebody and we talk about the program who says, you know what, I'm looking at things a little bit differently. I think about things a little bit differently. I may not agree with you, but it's made me think a little bit. And on this issue, which, understand, labor, you know, they're spending their time representing their work, their members, vigorously defending and representing their members. They don't have time to go out and put out billboards saying how wonderful they are. They don't buy ad time on television and radio saying, hey, look at us, how great we are. They're doing their job. They're doing what they do, and that's making people's lives better. Now, you've got a special interest with huge amounts of money. And, you know, as I think Irwin pointed out, using our money against us to push their poison. And I point to Wisconsin, and I talked about this the other day. This Glenn Grotham, one of the state senators there in Wisconsin, along with another one that he picked up, this Mark Bourne, another Republican there, evidently in Wisconsin, your employer cannot mandate that you work 7 days a week. It is in their law that they have to have a day off. It's just how it is. State workers have to have a day off during the week. Someday, it doesn't have to be Sunday like it started off to be, but it has to be a day off. Well, what our two Republican friends there in Wisconsin have decided they're going to do is, well, They're gonna repeal that, and they're gonna make it that, you know, if you want to, you can work 7 days in a row if you want. In fact, 14, 21, 28, you can work every day, every day, every day. Now, when Grotham was asked about it, he said, well, you know, some people want to work 7 days a week. Which, you know, I gotta be honest, I find very few people who really want to. They're in positions where they have to sometimes, but here's what gets me. When you allow these special interests to take over, because, you know, I remember working at times where the seventh day was optional. It was part of the contract. But they could demand a sixth day. And they wanted that ability to demand a seventh day. And the union said no by contract. But I remember the pressure. And this is, you know, we had a pretty strong contract. I remember during busy times, I remember the pressure that management put on people to work that seventh day. I remember the pressure and I can't even imagine how bad it would be in a place where you didn't have a union. And I've talked to people who say, you know, they don't give you a choice. You're working the seventh day in states that don't have what Wisconsin has. So what we're seeing across the country is a destruction of working conditions, a destruction of not just wages and benefits, but family values. Now, these are the people who tell us that they believe in family values. And here they are saying, well, we need you to work every single day. So on one hand, you've got the people who brought you the weekend. You've got labor unions who fought on picket lines and at the bargaining table so that you could have a 40-hour work week, so that we could have an opportunity to be with our families. And you've got now the business special interest. Because as I've been saying, look, there's always been the push-pull between capital and labor. It's always been there. The pendulum swings, basically, this swings to the middle and then back to the business community. It's kind of to the middle, a little bit over, and then all the way back. And we're in that swing back. What I'm saying is that right now is the time we say no more. No more at all. But don't you think it's interesting? Don't you think it's interesting that one of the things that they want to do is make their work weeks longer? I guess it just, well, it's what they do. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to download the podcast. Get the Stitcher app for your smartphone. Take the program on the go. I do answer all emails personally and use them on the program occasionally. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. As we are moving forward in all of this, because these attacks are here. Understand, the Koch brothers and the Wall Street money is here as we speak, organizing and spending lots of money on nice, colorful flyers, and they're going to be television and radio ads. We're going to be saturated with insanity. It's important to remember who benefits. Who benefits from giving up your workers' rights to organize? The Koch brothers and the people spending the money, right? That simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Infrastructure investment and jobs will be high priorities for the AFL-CIO in 2014. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the U.S. has a $3.6 trillion infrastructure deficit. The amount of money needed to adequately repair, restore, and upgrade America's infrastructure to remain globally competitive.
What would work best to grow our economy is a comprehensive strategy to invest in infrastructure and energy innovation. And I'm talking about measuring our investment in trillions with a T, a big investment to create jobs and spur our economy.
Trumka says he'll be listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech to judge the commitment to domestic policies that will help working people.
to make meaningful gains possible in the lives of typical working families. I want to hear about increases in the minimum wage, proposals for sick leave to help families and other measures to boost living standards, to help rebuild a strong middle class, and to stop the collapse of wages for working families.
Trumka says we can't let the ideological opposition of some Republicans derail public infrastructure investments. The AFL-CIO will try to partner with groups like the Chamber of Commerce to get infrastructure investments that would create badly needed jobs.
The Chamber and the AFL-CIO agree that the country's atrophying, that we need to meet the deficit that the Society of Civil Engineers places at $3.6 trillion. If you care about this country, if you care about the competitiveness of this country, we can't allow ideology to stop us from doing what's necessary to keep the American economy competitive and keep people working.
A new five-year national contract will be implemented for 13,000 UPS freight workers represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The workers voted overwhelmingly to approve the contract. It includes a $2.50 per hour raise over the five-year deal, making Teamster UPS workers the highest paid in the industry, according to the union. The union says the new contract also improves and protects pension benefits, lowers health insurance co-pays while maintaining strong benefits, provides the ability for more part-time workers to become full-time, and lowers the monthly cost for retiree health insurance. Every day that Republicans in Congress refuse to act to extend unemployment benefits, millions of dollars are lost to the economy, and long-term jobless workers grow increasingly desperate. Maura Stamper of Southgate, Michigan, was forced off unemployment benefits just before Christmas.
And if I wasn't married, I'd be on the street. I know there's lots of people that are on the street. And if this continues, we could very well lose our house that we've been in for 25 years. I just don't know how much more I can stress that we need these benefits. We need these benefits to survive, not to get rich, just to survive.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're not in this fight alone. This fight isn't just about Verizon, but about all the corporate greed in this country. You are done. We are here to put you down. Every last one of you corporate executives taking and raping from the average person. We are the working class. We are the 99%. We are the majority. You will not. You will not beat us. You will not win.
We're not gonna take it. No, we ain't gonna take it. We're not gonna take it anymore.
Welcome back to the Rich Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. So on Tuesday, a federal appeals court struck down the government's latest effort to require Internet providers to treat all web traffic equally. Basically, this means mobile carriers and other broadband providers may reach agreements for faster access to specific content crossing their networks, which means if, you know, you've got Rush Limbaugh who's going to spend a whole ton of money to get one of these providers to speed up, to put him to the front of the pack and speed up his connection, well, that means we'll probably be slowed down, and you're going to hear one thing. So basically we're seeing, or it appears that we're seeing a corporate takeover of what was supposed to be a free and open medium, which is why we've asked Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, their website, freepress.net. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm not really all that great. I look at this, and while it didn't get an awful lot of play in the media, this to me is fairly destructive.
It's very destructive. The internet has been in popular use for a little more than 30 years now, and as it becomes a more powerful medium, the powerful interests try to take it over. And this court decision was a major victory for those interests, because it basically says that powerful phone and cable companies, the companies that provide us with internet access, can now start to fiddle with the content that goes over the internet and prioritize certain websites and services over others and effectively take choice away from internet users. And the greatest thing about the internet is that why it's considered such a revolutionary medium is that it put choice in the hands of internet users. We could choose from millions upon millions of websites and services, and there's nothing to get in our way. Well, this rule change says that, in fact, they can get in our way and they can block our access to certain sites.
Yeah, because, Tim, we can't handle all that choice. You should have you should have two choices, this or that. You shouldn't have anything beyond that. We as just little minions, we're incapable of that kind of control, that kind of choice. It's just bad for us. So this is just kind of reining us back in.
I mean, you can look at a choice at a whole different array of levels. It's like we have all these choices of websites. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of choice of Internet access providers. In a lot of places, you're lucky if you have two, a dominant phone and a dominant cable company offering you services. Some places, they only have one. And when that company decides to block access or do things with your connection, we have very little choice to say, well, forget you, Comcast. Forget you, AT&T. Forget you, Verizon. I'm going to another service. Therefore, we're not only losing our ability to choose websites, but we've already lost our ability to choose among services. So it's a bad deal all around.
I agree. But some are saying that this is the fault of the FCC.
Yes.
Can you walk me through the argument? Because, you know, as it was explained to me, the FCC of the past made a bad designation that I guess they can change. Explain that.
Well, and the FCC under Bush, which had a Republican majority at the FCC, the majority of commissioners at the FCC reflects who the president is at that time. So under George W. Bush, the Republican FCC made a number of decisions to deregulate Internet access. The decision that they made was to limit the FCC's authority under the Communications Act. Now, along came the Obama FCC, and Obama, when he campaigned in 2008, was very outspoken in support of net neutrality. And they said, well, we're going to fix that. We're going to restore our authority at the FCC to protect users on the Internet. And the person that he put in place as his chairman at the FCC, Julius Genachowski, started talking about doing that, but he ended up really cowering before the power of the phone and cable lobby and not really putting together a rule that defends net neutrality. And it's his flimsy legal concoction, the rule that he passed at the FCC in 2010, that was just rejected by this federal appeals court in Washington, D.C.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the arguments that someone emailed me earlier was that, you know, you've got these companies like Netflix, who are what they call, bandwidth hogs. And this is just the kind of what their belief was, is that this will just rein them in. Everything else will be fine. Don't worry about it. Keep your head down. Everything will be wonderful.
Well, it won't rein in Netflix, because Netflix can now afford to pay. You know, see, what the ISPs want to do is to strike special deals with companies to say, hey, Netflix, you really want people to use your service, well, you give us extra money and we'll prioritize your traffic so people who have Netflix can get it. And that's fine. That works well for companies like Netflix that have a lot of money, that are already established in the marketplace. They can basically put their service at the front of the line. The problem is that those startup companies that may want to challenge Netflix in the live streaming business, or they may want to challenge Google in the search service, the smaller startups can no longer play because they can't buy access to the network that previously had been open. I mean, Google would not exist today were it not for net neutrality. I mean, we would be stuck with the Verizon search service or the Comcast search service, because they never would have let Google succeed on their network. They would have controlled the marketplace in a way that only allows a few dominant companies to win.
So if I'm getting this right, because now I'm starting to, the wheels are spinning. You go back to the Bush years, the people who told us that they believe in choice and they believe in competition, set us down this path where we're not going to have any choice, or there'll be no competition. And I shouldn't say or, no choice and no competition. Am I getting this right?
The amazing irony here is that sometimes you need baseline rules that preserve a true open market. And net neutrality was a rule that said, this is a level playing field. Anybody can come and play on the Internet. You all are going to be treated equally, And we'll let the customers decide which search service is the best, which news site that they like to use, which video streaming site they like to use. And so it ultimately puts choice in the hands of Internet users, which creates a true marketplace where supply meets demand and, you know, all of those things we learned in Economics 101 play themselves out on an Internet as long as you have a baseline rule that makes it what's called a common carrier, a level field upon which everybody can compete on equal terms.
I have to tell you, though, Tim, I'm really uncomfortable with these corporate giants, the Verizons, the Comcasts, having this kind of what, in my opinion, is going to turn into editorial control. You're going to get pushed based on speed to what they want you to see. And, you know, as we have this consolidation of message, you know, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read now controlled by a handful of companies, this only makes it worse.
Yes, and I mean, in fact, Verizon, as it was arguing its case before the court, said since corporations are individuals, we all know that now, it has the First Amendment right to, in its words, edit the Internet. And that was its basic argument. It was the sort of Orwellian take on what the First Amendment is supposed to do. It says that we as a corporation have a First Amendment right to censor everybody else. And that was the argument that they put forth. And so they are pursuing a strategy that allows them to pick and choose winners on the Internet. And, of course, that fundamentally changes the way the Internet has operated for the last 30 or so years, where it has been this level playing field. So we are, you know, this court decision basically creates this scenario where these very powerful companies have the power to destroy the open Internet, and there is no legal action that can be taken to stop them.
Now, I have a friend who says he's the chairman of the Tinfoil Hat Brigade. He told me this a couple years ago, where he said, you know, as people began to organize and actually come together on the Internet and form groups outside of, you know, buying cheap junk we don't need and looking at pornography, as people actually started using it as a tool of organizing, he said, you know, we're gonna see it destroyed. You know that. And, you know, I look at this and I go back to that moment. I go, here we are. It's in that process, isn't it?
Well, this is really about control. It's about control of information, and you know they used to call this the information age or the information revolution. Now we're looking at the counter revolution. It's a backlash of powerful interests who were really attempting to put the genie back in the bottle, and they're doing that by exerting their political and financial might in Washington D.C. to convince members of Congress, to convince people within the White House across the board that we need to hand the power of this network to these few companies that don't really own the network. They're the companies that allow us to get online. They provide what's called a last mile service to this network. And what we need to do is to start to look at the Internet not as a business but as a basic public utility that needs basic protection. That makes sure that users are served, and that we don't find ourselves in a situation like we're finding ourselves in today.
Is it possible for us to go and write this somehow through either legislation, appeal?
Yeah.
Where does this go?
This is the good news. This is the silver lining on this very dark cloud. The silver lining is in this court decision. They basically laid out a roadmap for what the Federal Communications Commission can do, and what they need to do is to reassert their authority to protect consumers, protect Internet users, under what's called Title II of the Communications Act. The Republican FCC, the FCC under the George W. Bush administration, changed that authority under Title I, which is a much weaker authority, and they have within their power to reassert, to reclassify their authority under Title II. So we're now looking to the new chairman at the FCC, a fellow by the name of Tom Wheeler, to do that. And at Free Press, our organization at freepress.net, we have an action that people can take to urge the chairman to reclassify the FCC's powers under Title II and allow us then to return the internet to this sort of open network that has been so important to everyone.
So there's a silver lining here, and something can be done. So the question is will it?
The question is, will it? Well, it will if we can get enough people to take action. It's a political game in Washington, and unfortunately right now the conventional wisdom, both among Republicans and Democrats, is that reclassifying the FCC's authority is a quote-unquote nuclear option. But it really isn't that bad if you look at it. There's no downside to their doing this other than that, you know, the phone and cable lobby will exert all of their might to try to stop it. But as we've learned at Free Press, you can organize against money like that with a lot of very impassioned people who want to save the internet.
Because this seems to me that
we've been successful in the past, and we hope to be successful again.
Yeah, this seems to me that this should be one of those bipartisan things where even the most right-wing Tea Party Republicans should be going, I don't want corporate America owning my ability to rail against the government. And on the other side, you should have both sides of the political spectrum coming together saying, whoa, I don't want corporate America owning our internet.
Yeah, well, you know, there are even libertarians out there who think, you know, the base, what's most important is to preserve competition in a marketplace. And the only way that you can do that is by not allowing these powerful companies to dictate terms.
It does cross
the aisles, political aisle, and there has been a lot of support from all sectors.
So how do we get involved? What do we do?
Well, you can go to freepress.net. We have an action there. We also run a coalition site at savetheinternet.com. At savetheinternet.com, where people can sign on to an action. We're going to be doing a lot more over the 2014. This issue is going to be with us for a while here before we can convince this chairman to do the right thing. So people should get involved now, and there are a lot of other things that they can do over the coming months.
And we'd love to have you come back often. Keep us updated on what's going on with this extremely important issue throughout this year. Tim, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
And thanks, Rick. It's an important issue. Thanks for covering it.
Again, the website, freepress.net. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Tim Carr's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. In his new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, New York Magazine journalist Gabriel Sherman describes the start of Sean Hannity's career as a conservative radio personality on KCSB, the UC Santa Barbara college station. The short-lived show was canceled in 1989 after Hannity made a number of extremely derogatory smears about gay people. Here's one of them.
I think anyone listening to the show that believes homosexuality is just a normal lifestyle has been brainwashed. And, you know, it's very dangerous if we start accepting lower and lower forms of behavior as the normal. They try and equate homosexuality with, you know, with the rights of, say, minorities. They try and group it in the same link, and it has nothing to do with it.
And here is his interaction with a caller who tells Hannity that she is a lesbian mother.
This lady just had a child, you know. Do you know how they do that now?
In the ever-escalating competition to be the number one big-time college football program in the nation, Ohio State University bulked up last fall with a monster recruit named Max. Actually, it's not the coaching staff that signed up this brute, but the OSU Campus Police Department. And the recruit's full name is Max Pro, not a football player, but a 19-ton armored fighting vehicle built by a Pentagon contractor to withstand, quote, ballistic arms fire, minefields, IEDs, and nuclear, biological, and chemical environments. Wow, college games really have gotten rough. But the campus PD, which received the Max Pro as a gift from the Pentagon, i.e. us taxpayers, says it's not just playing games. Max is available for big actions, like hostage scenarios, killers loose on campus, and extreme flooding of up to 3 feet. Well, have such things been a problem at OSU? No. Would a huge, slow, gas-guzzling vehicle designed for warfare be effective if any of the above were actually to occur? No one in the department wanted to tackle that question. Oh, by the way, operating and maintaining these machines requires specially trained and licensed personnel. Are any of OSU's officers qualified? Again, no answer from headquarters. Also, the vehicles are subject to frequent rollovers, and they lack the ability to go off-road or to maneuver in confined areas. That doesn't sound ideal for a college campus. But the gendarmes say they've adjusted Max to fit their needs. How? By removing the gun turret and repainting the vehicle. This is Jim Hightower saying, OSU police finally admitted that Max's chief role would be to provide a police presence on football game days. Great. Police authorities now believe they need a show of military force to keep tailgaters in check.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
When the blew the horn, the walls came down. They all knew war, but the walls came down. I don't think there are any Russians. There ain't no Yankees. Just corporate criminals.
One 888 520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So, you know, everything in the hands of the corporate special interests, the monopolization of the nation. And, you know, I look towards this whole push towards privatizing education. Another one of these wonderful charter schools. Oh, these fantastic, wonderful charter schools, kind of in the birthplace of it in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Turns out, the state of Wisconsin had given this Life Skills Academy more than $2 million in taxpayer money over the last couple of years. And according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Life Skills Academy basically just closed their doors just before Christmas, and nobody seems to know where they are. They went and they asked the guy who's the head of the All Saints Catholic Church there in Milwaukee, who had rented these folks at the Life Skills Academy a building to have their school in. He said they moved out, as people say, in the dead of the night. Now you go through and you look at last year, the full school year. Last year, only one of Life Skills students actually had grades or scores high enough to manage them into the proficient range of reading and math. Only one. But they did have the right message, though. The school's motto was, "One awesome God, two great schools." And you got to kind of wonder how running away like thieves in the night, how that squares biblically. Not quite sure. According to their website, they pledge to lead students into a genuine relationship with Christ while providing an excellent academic program. To this, we will strive to continue. Until they didn't, and they left town. No mention if the money will be recovered. No mention what's going to happen to those students. And you got to wonder, you know, how many. And I go back to this, because we're doing it here in Pennsylvania, too, this whole push towards charter schools, because there's the corporate special interest. There's the billionaire class, the people who know, they know better. They're the benevolent ones. They will dictate how our education system functions. And, of course, you know, it's like anything. You got to give them a little piece of it. And here's your slice, Mr. Koch brother. And I look at this and I go, you know, all the money we've wasted. First and foremost, you look at the resources that we've wasted that we could have really invested in our public schools, and we didn't. But more importantly, look at all the lives that are going to be screwed up because of this. You got to wonder how many kids in that school now will become dropouts as they move on. And what's frustrating to me is, right down the line, the right wing of this country has their ideology, and they pound it into us time and time again. It's always there. It's omnipresent. and they use hate and fear to kind of blind us from the reality that the poison that they're pushing, the stuff that they're pushing towards us, the privatization of our education, the privatization of every state function, and then the destruction of workers' rights, somehow is good for us. And I guess it takes us back to the benevolent robber barons of the past, who, you know, as long as you did what you were supposed to, as long as you led your life the way they told you to, that you had to live it, you might get by. You might be able to just feed your family and, you know, keep your head down, do what you don't raise any trouble, and don't ask for too much. You'll get what you get, and you won't throw a fit. And we won't have to beat you in public. But what's going on is, and you're seeing this all across the country, is now the very well-to-do, with the power of their think tanks. And look, they've invested heavily in infrastructure. And that's one of the things Democrats don't do. There is really nothing in the form of infrastructure. And I don't really know that there can be. Because understand, our corporate-controlled media is in existence for one reason. They were able to bring in advertiser money. So when you have corporate America saying, you know, we're gonna spend 10% of our profits to push an ideology, like they did in the Powell memo, you end up with these core tenets of the corporatist party. That means, you know, your kid's gonna go to a private school where somebody's gonna profit and not get the education that you would think from a private school. You're going to see your right to organize eviscerated. You're going to see all state functions and everything in the hands of profiteers. And they think that this is going to move us in the right direction. And, you know, I guess you look at Iraq right now. Because if you remember, you go back to Bush taking us into Iraq. They made Iraq the conservative paradise. They did everything they wanted to do. Here, there, all of their little think tank models, all of their academic models, all of the bad plays that haven't worked anywhere else. Let's try it there. Let's allow capital to fly in and out of the country, repatriate money without any tax. Let's outlaw labor unions. Let's deregulate everything. It's the Wild West of corporate wet dreams. And it's chaos still. And then you got Republicans going, see, it's chaos. Obama didn't do anything. Are you kidding me? It's kind of like Boehner saying that Obama didn't inspect the freedom industries in West Virginia that ended up contaminating 18% of the state's water supply. It's ludicrous. It is absolutely mind-blowingly ludicrous that someone like Boehner, who's been pushing for deregulation and strangling government oversight his entire career, is now going to stand up and say, somebody should have inspected that. I mean, doesn't that make you take pause? I mean, if it weren't so tragic, it would be funny. But at some point, you've got to call BS. You've got to go, hey, come on, BS. Same thing with these charter schools and all down the line. And I'm told, and a little bit later on we'll talk about it some more, but I'm told, you know, privatizing the liquor stores are back on the table. You know, it's like these guys in Harrisburg don't have anything to do. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk about Michigan and what's going on since they rammed through the right-to-work law. And I got to be honest, in the worst possible fashion, in a term-limited year where there's no accountability, which is why I'm against term limits, they just rammed it through like thieves in the night because, hey, they need a job too, right? But we'll find out how things have gone since then. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yeah.
Smith Show.
You're listening to WIND, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Infrastructure investment and jobs will be high priorities for the AFL-CIO in 2014. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the U.S. has a $3.6 trillion infrastructure deficit. The amount of money needed to adequately repair, restore, and upgrade America's infrastructure to remain globally competitive.
What would work best to grow our economy is a comprehensive strategy to invest in infrastructure and energy innovation. And I'm talking about measuring our investment in trillions with a T, a big investment to create jobs and spur our economy.
Trumka says he'll be listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech to judge the commitment to domestic policies that will help working people.
To make meaningful gains possible in the lives of typical working families. I want to hear about increases in the minimum wage, proposals for sick leave to help families and other measures to boost living standards, to help rebuild a strong middle class, and to stop the collapse of wages for working families.
Trumka says we can't let the ideological opposition of some Republicans derail public infrastructure investments. The AFL-CIO will try to partner with groups like the Chamber of Commerce to get infrastructure investments that would create badly needed jobs.
Chamber and the AFL-CIO agree that the country's atrophying, that we need to meet the deficit that the Society of Civil Engineers places at $3.6 trillion. If you care about this country, if you care about the competitiveness of this country, we can't allow ideology to stop us from doing what's necessary to keep the American economy competitive and keep people working.
A new five-year national contract will be implemented for 13,000 UPS freight workers represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The workers voted overwhelmingly to approve the contract. It includes a $2.50 per hour raise over the five-year deal, making Teamster UPS workers the highest paid in the industry, according to the union. The union says the new contract also improves and protects pension benefits, lowers health insurance co-pays while maintaining strong benefits, provides the ability for more part-time workers to become full-time, and lowers the monthly cost for retiree health insurance. Every day that Republicans in Congress refuse to act to extend unemployment benefits, millions of dollars are lost to the economy, and long-term jobless workers grow increasingly desperate. Maura Stamper of Southgate, Michigan, was forced off unemployment benefits just before Christmas.
And if I wasn't married, I'd be on the street. I know there's lots of people that are on the street. And if this continues, we could very well lose our house that we've been in for 25 years. I just don't know how much more I can stress that we need these benefits. We need these benefits to survive, not to get rich, just to survive.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right to work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make believe, and we don't buy that. Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down, while the boss man takes his bonus pay, jets on out of town. DC's bailing out the bankers as a farmer's auction ground. Yeah, while they're living it up on Wall Street in that New York City town, here in the real Detroit down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So as I've been saying, you know, in 2011 we were in Wisconsin saying, look, hey, folks, the insanity is going to be at our doorstep soon enough. We'll start preparing for it. Get ready for it. All the BS we're going to hear, all the nonsense, all the misinformation, all the rhetoric. We need to be prepared for the message that's coming. And as it rolled through Indiana and into Ohio and Michigan and Tennessee and all across the country, kept saying, hey, we need to be prepared. Well, all of that insanity right here, right now, and we're going to be hearing an awful lot about this wonderful utopian society that our conservative friends want to bring us in the form of right to work. Who could possibly be against someone having the right to work? And if it meant actually having a right to a job and rights on the job, I'd be all in favor of it. This, the poison that Wall Street is selling us, not so much. Which is why we've asked Roland Zullo, a PhD professor at Michigan University. He's also the assistant research scientist at the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations there. Roland, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure.
So we've heard this message that this thing, right to work, this wonderful thing that Michigan did is creating tons of jobs, wages are going up, things are just wonderful. Is that accurate?
Well, no. It's really a mixed picture. Some colleagues and I at Illinois analyzed data recently, looking at 10 years' worth of data, and we found that the story really is a mixed picture for what right to work is connected to. And I say connected to because in social science, we try to establish a causal relationship, and it just is very difficult to find any kind of causal relationship between right to work and a thriving economy. But what we found was this. We found that, contrary to what is often said, right to work doesn't appear to be associated with any new manufacturing jobs.
But I just read today, the Right to Work Foundation here in Pennsylvania, they just sent me a thing today that said, you know what, in Indiana, tons of manufacturing went there, and when you talk to this relocation specialist, whom I've never heard of, they say the number one thing employers are looking for when they look to go to another state is if it's a right to work state or not, which I got to be honest, sounds kind of ludicrous to me, but that's
the
point.
Well, yeah, surveys of corporations put right to work very low on the list. Way above that are subsidies, tax abatements, infrastructure help, and also things like education, whether the workforce is educated and trained. So there's other priorities that corporations have when they make relocation decisions. But in terms of jobs itself, if you look at again, let me just explain what the difficulty is so listeners know. The trouble is that many of your right to work states are located in the South. And the South has developed later than other places in the country, than the Northeast or the coastal West or here in the Midwest. And so because of that, they're seeing a little faster growth right now than other parts of the country, a little faster economic growth. It's slowing down some, but in the past decade, they saw a little bit faster job growth. Now, some of that is because there are people in the North retiring and moving down South. Of course, when they go down South, they sell their home up here in Michigan. They go down South, they buy a home down there, and they begin buying, purchasing and contributing to the economy down there. So what we see, in effect, is some growth in service jobs in these right-to-work states. But what we don't see are manufacturing. So the notion that companies are following or are relocating because of right-to-work, at least manufacturing firms, there doesn't appear to be any evidence.
So you're not seeing any, because what I keep hearing, Roland, is that you pass this, and it's direct cause and effect. You pass this, jobs come fleeing in, wages are raised, and everyone's happy, and it's this utopian, wonderful place. I'm getting.
Well, but the trouble is, to push this politically, what happens is that people conjure up a cause that really isn't there. So here in Michigan, for example, we're starting to see some job growth, especially in auto. And when all the auto jobs grow, we see job growth in other areas too as well. There's a very large multiplier effect from auto jobs.
Right.
Okay. Now we've seen this, and the auto industry bottomed out a couple of years ago, back during when the bankruptcy took place, and now they're engaged in a comeback. Well, part of the reason why they're engaged in a comeback is because the UAW negotiated a deal with the auto industry. And it, the deal went something like this, that, you know, they would accept some of the terms of the bankruptcy, which included, you know, having to deal with, which it was very difficult for them to swallow, was this two-tiered system. They didn't want to do it, but they agreed to that. But part of the deal, part of what the auto workers got in return was a promise to return jobs back here to Michigan.
Right.
Okay, so we're seeing some job growth here in Michigan because of that negotiated deal. Had nothing to do with the right to work. But you can be certain that there will be folks out there talking about the right to work law, which has been in effect less than a year now in Michigan. But you'll certainly there'll be folks standing up and claiming that right to work was the cause, and it wasn't. It was because of a deal negotiated years before right to work happened, and it was negotiated between the labor union and major auto industry players. Had nothing to do with right to work. Indiana also benefits from some of that too. Indiana has quite a bit of auto industry. Or industry that feeds into and supplies auto as well. So they're benefiting in part because of the auto boom.
So as we're seeing this, and look, we're going to see those stories coming out. And the reality is, I think you're spot on. As the auto industry that conservatives are so angry at that we bailed out continues to grow and rebound, you're going to have those ancillary jobs. Like where I grew up in Cleveland, you had a Ford and a Chevy plant there, and those plants had tons of little feeder factories around them that made, the windshield wiper or
everything.
Everything. Yeah. All around the facility, which had that, as you called it, a multiplier effect, which created more jobs in the area. And to me, one of the things that I absolutely agreed with this president on was helping the audio industry, to get its feet back to be able to create those kind of jobs.
Yeah, it meant hundreds of thousands of jobs. It really did. And, we don't know what would have happened had a bankruptcy taken a harsher course, but I think in hindsight, certainly that was the right decision.
So as we move forward, because the reason I asked you to come on and talk about, because you lived through the fight there in Michigan and yeah, the rhetoric that is coming our way, and I wanted to begin to prepare our listeners for, hey, this is what we're going to be hearing again. This is the message. Right now they're pushing this this Orwellian speak called paycheck protection.
Right.
Call it what you want, deception, destruction, distraction. All it is we're going to go after public sector workers and stick it to them first. And then we'll get to everybody else later, but they're first on the agenda. But
that's how it happened here in Michigan. So, and that's also how it happened in Wisconsin, too. They went after public sector workers in a very
savage
way.
As you silence one group, they move on to the next. And I wanted to walk through some of that, because as you pointed out, this is the same path they followed in Michigan.
Yeah, okay. Well, here's some of the things to expect. Our right-to-work laws were passed in December 2012, and it happened in a very rushed fashion. There's a lame duck session just after the November elections, when Republicans lost about five seats. I think they lost five seats in the assembly, and they saw the tide turning and decided to get their shot, and they passed a slew of laws. Our governor signed them. There was no debate on right to work. It was just done. And so expect that kind of urgency. That's the way. Because the urgency prevents any real political opposition from forming.
Right.
That, it prevents people from asking serious questions. Another thing you can expect is that what the right to work folks do is they like to find unionists out there who are unhappy with their union. And so they bring these folks around in buses to take part in these activities to make it appear as though there's a popular movement among unionists for right to work, which is false. I mean, the right to work just simply isn't one of those dinner room, still aren't.
Tim, I wish I could just get rid of my voice and give up all those benefits and that, all those wages and all that. I wish I could just get rid of that stuff. That isn't what you don't hear that, do you?
Well, I don't think it's been a room conversation, right? Right to work. It might be among, you know, labor households or people who are very aware of the issue, but for most people, I don't think they really believe that a right to work law, once it's explained to folks, once people know what it really means. And in fact, in polling here in Michigan, most citizens opposed it in Michigan. The reason why it was passed is because we're a very gerrymandered state. So,
like us.
That's how it was passed. And so we got it. It was pushed through quickly, completely partisan fashion. It was all Republican votes for it. There were a few Republicans who didn't vote for it to protect their seat. None of the Democrats voted for it. And it was passed in a, you know, very partisan way, very rapidly, without any debate whatsoever, as if the discussion had already taken place and it hadn't. So that's what you have to aware of something coming fast and, you know, using the media in a way and using these workers in a way as props to sort of sell the idea that there's a popular movement in favor of right to work when there really is.
No, I mean, we're seeing everything you just said, we are seeing being played out. Our legislature is adding a couple more days into the calendar here in February. Because they have this sense of urgency. The Koch brothers were in town, I guess, over Christmas, promising to double whatever money labor or progressive groups give to them so that they push their poison through. We're seeing just what you said. That's the playbook. And it just didn't happen in Michigan. It just didn't happen in Wisconsin. This has been the MO of the Alec types and the Koch brothers and the American for Prosperity types, all of them. This is it, and it's what's here.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about here, and there's a lot to talk about. But, you know, one of the arguments you'll hear is that what right to work does is it makes unions more honest, right? Because what it does is it allows people who belong to a union to register their disapproval by pulling their dues out of the union.
Well, they can do that anyway.
Well, you can, yeah, but this is what you'll hear. And so one of the arguments out there is that what right to work does is it makes unions better unions. The trouble with that argument is first, there's no evidence supporting it, but there are other ways of requiring unions to be more democratic, say, and without having to withdraw people's dues, which a union needs to function, and those are completely outlawed by the right to work law here in Michigan. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. There are some unions that what they do is they allow people who are covered by the union contract. They got all the benefits of being a union member, but they allow them to, instead of paying dues, to contribute an equal amount to charity. Now, why do they do that? They do that because occasionally there are union members or union-covered persons who object to unions on religious grounds. So they allow them to take that money instead and contribute it to charity. And what that does, that kind of plan, what it does is it eliminates the economic incentive to withdraw from support of the union. It requires people to pay an equal amount, as if they were union members, as if they were dues-paying members. Well, that kind of policy, that kind of union security clause is prohibited under Michigan law. And my guess is the law that's being peddled in Pennsylvania also prohibits that. See, because the folks pushing right to work really don't want to make unions better. What they want to do is take away their funding so they can't function, especially in the political arena.
And make them go
away.
That's
really the objective.
And that's, you've cut to the heart of it. It's about destroying labor's power and their ability to influence policy. And what gets me is you listen to these folks who are peddling this right to work stuff. They act as if labor has this huge amount of power, that they're the majority, and then, you know, we hear big labor and big union bosses. And we're talking about 7% of the private sector workforce. I mean, last time I checked, 93% was much bigger than 7%.
Yeah, they try to make labor appear to be, much larger and much more troublesome than they are. But here's an important thing to think about too. One of the things that makes us a healthy democracy is that all groups across our society have some representation at the state level or the federal level or even the local political level. And, you know, other than labor unions, other than organized labor, there's really no institutions out there really speaking on behalf of wage earners. There's really, you know, there's no replacement for it. So if you neuter the ability for labor unions to act politically, you've really undermined our democracy in important ways. You've taken away the voice of working people because, you know, as you know, labor unions aren't just negotiating contracts for themselves. They're also trying to pass policy like a higher minimum wage or a health and safety law that protects all workers. And if you eliminate labor's political power, which is really the aim of right to work, then you've really undercut the ability for, you know, wage earners to be protected and to actually someday have middle-class jobs.
So then that brings me back to the question I always ask. And anything that's being peddled to us, who benefits? So when you look at, because we're hearing it, we're going to free these workers from this onerous, these heavy-handed unions. We're going to make them free and give them all this wonderful freedom from the benevolent employer and all this. Who benefits from passing these type of laws?
Well, what it does is it weakens labor, and so it strengthens the hands of the chambers of commerce.
There you go.
Association of Manufacturers, all the folks who would rather see more power in the hands of the owners of businesses. So, those would be the winners, and it is, of course, the really a group of economic elite who are funding this whole right to work movement. Again, there's not a popular clamor for right to work. It's a well-orchestrated, corporate-funded movement, and, you know, folks need to realize.
And that's what we need to be fighting back against. Roland, I appreciate you taking time for us, filling us in on what happened there in Michigan. We'd love to have you come back again as this continues down the road to give us your valuable insight and also your thoughts.
Okay. My pleasure, Rick.
Appreciate the time. Roland Zulu, Assistant Research Scientist at the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of truck and deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who was willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence of worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Experience. We're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science and man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
This is the end. Nah, it's not climate, blah, 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 science. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I got to be honest. You know, Roland gave the game plan. It is exactly what he said. It's this hurry up, hush, rush, rush, rush. We got to get it done, got to get it done. Which is why they're secretly behind closed doors, twisting arms, making deals, making promises. We need to be careful the next couple of months. This is something that the Republicans see themselves right now, I think, as cornered rats. This is the end of it for them. They know that in November their guy's going down in the governor's mansion, and this is the end of their dictatorial control. And all of their bad ideas, all of their horrible policies, all of the stuff that they've prioritized for the last couple of years, it's going to end. No more privatization of our assets, no more handing out, no more fire sales, no more huge tax breaks for their buddies. All ends. So it's going to be a hurry up and rush kind of thing the next couple of weeks. It's just, you know, it's coming, so we got to prepare for it. And we got to speed dial our representatives. Let's take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show.
It's desperate times, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Brought the billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have put into a cap
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Infrastructure investment and jobs will be high priorities for the AFL-CIO in 2014. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the U.S. has a $3.6 trillion infrastructure deficit. The amount of money needed to adequately repair, restore, and upgrade America's infrastructure to remain globally competitive.
What would work best to grow our economy is a comprehensive strategy to invest in infrastructure and energy innovation. And I'm talking about measuring our investment in trillions with a T, a big investment to create jobs and spur our economy.
Trumka says he'll be listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech to judge the commitment to domestic policies that will help working people.
To make meaningful gains possible in the lives of typical working families. I want to hear about increases in the minimum wage, proposals for sick leave to help families and other measures to boost living standards, to help rebuild a strong middle class, and to stop the collapse of wages for working families.
Trumka says we can't let the ideological opposition of some Republicans derail public infrastructure investments. The AFL-CIO will try to partner with groups like the Chamber of Commerce to get infrastructure investments that would create badly needed jobs.
The Chamber and the AFL-CIO agree that the country's atrophying, that we need to meet the deficit that the Society of Civil Engineers places at $3.6 trillion. If you care about this country, if you care about the competitiveness of this country, we can't allow ideology to stop us from doing what's necessary to keep the American economy competitive and keep people working.
A new five-year national contract will be implemented for 13,000 UPS freight workers represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The workers voted overwhelmingly to approve the contract. It includes a $2.50 per hour raise over the five-year deal, making Teamster UPS workers the highest paid in the industry, according to the union. The union says the new contract also improves and protects pension benefits, lowers health insurance co-pays while maintaining strong benefits, provides the ability for more part-time workers to become full-time, and lowers the monthly cost for retiree health insurance. Every day that Republicans in Congress refuse to act to extend unemployment benefits, millions of dollars are lost to the economy, and long-term jobless workers grow increasingly desperate. Maura Stamper of Southgate, Michigan, was forced off unemployment benefits just before Christmas.
And if I wasn't married, I'd be on the street. I know there's lots of people that are on the street. And if this continues, we could very well lose our house that we've been in for 25 years. I just don't know how much more I can stress that we need these benefits. We need these benefits to survive, not to get rich, just to survive.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range. The coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons of metal a day, now so you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name. In Youngstown, in Youngstown.
1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the North American International Auto Show going on this week, and General Motors kicked it off by sweeping a couple of the awards. In fact, they got the Car of the Year and the Truck of the Year. The Chevy Corvette Stingray was the Sports Car of the Year, and the Silverado pickup truck. The Truck of the Year. These awards have been given out annually since about 1994 at the beginning of the auto show there in Detroit, selected from a panel of automotive journalists from North America. 28 cars were considered, 18 trucks, and utility vehicles. The Corvette, it's the sixth time the Corvette has won such an award. The last time being 1998. And you know what I find interesting, and I go back to my conversation with Roland, that, you know, the auto industry that the conservatives so badly wanted to see go under. And I truly believe it was solely because those were unionized workers. I really believe that. I believe it was this hatred that the right in this country has of workers who have contracts, who have the ability to make a decent wage and also have a say. I find it very, very interesting that they are so dead set against rescuing this industry. Didn't have a problem going after, you know, and bailing out Wall Street. But these workers and their pensions, no, never mind them. And I think Roland hit on another point there. The reason that it's turning around a little bit is because the huge concessions. And to me, that's, you know, you have to sit down and you have to negotiate. And what we're seeing is this push by the Wall Street types, by the Koch brothers and others, these big business, you know, the robber barons of today. They don't want to negotiate. They want to impose. And I think, you know, we've been through this a number of times to the point where I think we should know this by now. So I look at this and I go, you know, it's turning around. You're starting to see jobs being created and all of those secondary jobs. Now, I go back to when I was a kid. You know, you go back and you look at the Ford and the Chevy plant there and all of the little machine shops all around there. All of those places paid better than average wages at the time to compete with the wages of the auto industry. So by having the contract, by having the union, by having this ability to negotiate for some of the profits that you're creating, you bring everyone else up. So even if those plants around the Ford plant or the Chevy plant weren't unionized, their wages were raised because of it. And we need to, I think, start thinking back in terms of how did we have a couple of generations of increased standard of living? And now that we're seeing a stagnation, you know, going back to that whole cause-effect thing, you know, what caused wages to rise? Was it the benevolency of the guy sitting in the corner office? No. It was sitting down and saying, we want to see the books. We want to see what we've created, and we want a piece of it. And now that we've seen the other side of this, as wages and conditions and everything start spiraling down, what's the cause of that? And the cause of it is this kind of senseless attack, like we're going to see in the next couple of months here. And we better be prepared for it. I came across an interesting article talking about the auto industry. They're worried, and this is what blows my mind. And I guess I've thought of this a couple of times as I've seen, you know, BMW and Mercedes and Volvo and other quote unquote premium brand luxury cars advertising on TV. You know, like anyone could have it. You know, anyone could drive a BMW, and anyone could have the Lexus or any of these luxury cars. What the industry's worrying about is that if they continue down this path of you know, bringing down, you know, making luxury type vehicles under their brand name for the masses, well, it's going to take away from their big price tag cars, and they're afraid that it's going to hurt them. And, you know, as one guy pointed out, you know, when people look at the Nissan Maxima or the Buick LaCrosse, you know, they think this has a certain status, a certain brand, which is why they're not going out and buying the Hyundai Genesis. According to the article, you know, as they point out, if everyone's driving a BMW or a Lexus or a Mercedes, if everyone's doing it, you're not special anymore. And they're starting to think about this in a very different way. So it's going to be interesting to see the marketing strategies over the next couple of years as, you know, the auto industry started going, hey, everyone could buy this. And hey, here's the Mercedes, I guess it was the CLA class. It was a small sedan, you know, just under 30,000, where you go, wow, I can drive a Mercedes. Mercedes is kind of rethinking that now. You kind of got to wonder. Now, Mercedes is saying it's their breakthrough car. They say it's, you know, it's not going to really harm their big brand because people are still going to want these big brands because, of course, you're not going to have all the options and the gadgets and the whatnots, which, you know, am I the only one who thinks there's just too many gadgets in a car? I mean, my wife, when she bought our minivan, you know, she went in and this is one of those moments that you go, shouldn't have done this. She went in, and my wife's a gadget fiend. If it's got buttons or switches or flashing lights, she wants it. And she went in, and she got everything in this minivan. And to her defense, she said, if I have to drive a minivan, I have to at least have something to make it interesting to me. So she went in, and she negotiated this minivan with every option you could possibly imagine. And then I come walking in, and the guy goes, here's the bill. And I'm going, no. That's not going to happen. And at the moment, I had to do damage control to figure out how much of my wallet I'm going to lose at that day. And I think I did all right. But, you know, here again, you've got all these gadgets, all of this stuff. And to me, it seems a huge waste. I'm just driving from one place to another. I don't necessarily need, you know, wireless internet access as I'm driving down the road. I don't want, you know, heated and air-conditioned seats. But you know, you look at all of these things that they're now putting into the most entry-level cars. And what they're saying is by doing all this stuff at the entry-level cars, you know, they're kind of going, you know, maybe it's going to hurt the brand. Now they're saying, look, you can get, once you get the really expensive cars, you get the more powerful engine, you get a bunch of other upgrades, maybe it's going to be a little bit bigger, a little more roomy. It's just, you know, one of those things that I thought was quite interesting in reading through the story as, you know, we just had Christmas and I was watching all these commercials and it brought me into a thought that I was having that going, wow, you know, everybody can own a BMW now and everyone can own a Mercedes now because they're, you know, just about the same price as the Fords and the Buicks. And it's interesting to see that they're going, well, you know, maybe we might want to start, rethinking it a little bit. But, you know, I go back to this, to Detroit, and I'm glad to hear that there are jobs coming back. In the context of this right to work, because I think this is kind of the issue of our day right now. It's kind of the thing that I'm personally focused on. When the reports start coming out, and I've read a bunch of them here recently that point to Indiana and they point to Michigan and they point to Wisconsin and say, oh, there's all this job growth. Even though, honestly, the unemployment numbers haven't come down that much. You've had more people dropping out of the workforce than you've had actually finding jobs. A part of it, and this was an argument that you heard a lot of, especially in Indiana. Michigan, you didn't have a lot of time to go through and really argue it, because as Roland Zulu said, they pushed it through, they rammed it through like thieves in the night. It was a breakneck pace. There was no time for hearings. There was no time for debate. Much like we're going to have no hearing on this paycheck destruction bill, we're going to have no real hearings or real debate over what's going to move forward. They're going to impose their will because they've got the numbers. And right now they're twisting some arms and they're putting pressure on people that they think they can put pressure on to put it through. In Indiana especially, what they argued was is they could steal jobs from Illinois. They could steal jobs from other states. I think we're going to hear that here as well. You're going to hear, hey, we can steal from New Jersey. Hey, we can steal from Ohio. Hey, we can steal from New York. And in Indiana, there were a few cases of that. Not the numbers that the right to work people say, but there were a few cases of people go, oh, okay, yeah, hey, along with huge amounts of subsidies. So every one of these things, I think it's important to look at this stuff with a jaundiced eye and say, okay, well, here's what they're selling me. What do I look at? When those companies came in to get away from those states that weren't right to work, they came in for huge subsidies, for lots of money. That's the other part of this. And I think Roland was spot on. Look, there's no evidence whatsoever that says that these companies, that's what they're looking for. You know, I've talked to relocation people. They say they look for location. Location, location, location. Those are the three things. Can I get my product to the most people in the shortest amount of time? And do you have infrastructure to help me get it there? And do you have an educated workforce to build it? That's what they're looking for. Then come the other stuff, the taxes, the tax breaks, what freebies and sweeteners come along with it. And then well down the list, anything having to do with unions. You know, I often wish that unions had the strength and the power that the right to work people say they do. This is them taking the opportunity to say, you know what? They're struggling. They're weak because we've allowed the laws to be broken for so long. We've used the courts against workers for so long. Now it's time to crush them. Now it's time to take them out in public and show everybody that we're going to gut them. To me, that's what this is about. Pure and simple. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Sign away our rights to be wildcat striking. You know they're gonna push us around. Mr. Pep and Diggin, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap and Diggin, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to crew on down. This Tap can dig it, Mr. Hartley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In the ever-escalating competition to be the number one big-time college football program in the nation, Ohio State University bulked up last fall with a monster recruit named Max. Actually, it's not the coaching staff that signed up this brute, but the OSU Campus Police Department. And the recruit's full name is Max Pro. Not a football player, but a 19-ton armored fighting vehicle built by a Pentagon contractor to withstand, quote, ballistic arms fire, minefields, IEDs, and nuclear, biological, and chemical environments. Wow, college games really have gotten rough. But the campus PD, which received the Max Pro as a gift from the Pentagon, i.e. us taxpayers, says it's not just playing games. Max is available for big actions, like hostage scenarios, killers loose on campus, and extreme flooding of up to 3 feet. Well, have such things been a problem at OSU? No. Would a huge, slow, gas-guzzling vehicle designed for warfare be effective if any of the above were actually to occur? No one in the department wanted to tackle that question. Oh, by the way, operating and maintaining these machines requires specially trained and licensed personnel. Are any of OSU's officers qualified? Again, no answer from headquarters. Also, the vehicles are subject to frequent rollovers, and they lack the ability to go off-road or to maneuver in confined areas. That doesn't sound ideal for a college campus. But the gendarmes say they've adjusted Max to fit their needs. How? By removing the gun turret and repainting the vehicle. This is Jim Hightower saying OSU police finally admitted that Max's chief role would be to provide a police presence on football game days. Great. Police authorities now believe they need a show of military force to keep tailgaters in check.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Welcome back to the Rich Smith Show. So today, back in 1929, Dr. Martin Luther King was born. And, you know, he wrote a book, All Labor Has Dignity. This idea, and, you know, what I like some of my, I shouldn't say I like, I have some friends who think, well, you know, he just stood up for, you know, for racial equality. I said, that was only a part of it. The dream was economic equality. Understand that you can't have equality in race or at anything until you've got the ability to afford it. And, you know, you go back to when we did our labor history tour over the summer, when we ended up in Memphis where he was assassinated, where he was murdered. He was there for a sanitation worker strike, saying that, you know, if you remember the I Am a Man campaign, this idea that that I should be able to support myself, my family, should be able to retire. Which one of the weird things we found out while we were there in Memphis is that those sanitation workers that King was in town back in the 60s to fight for, they still to this day do not have a pension. And, you know, while we were there talking to a couple of the workers who were sanitation workers, they said there were guys just recently in his 70s who dropped on the job because he didn't have a pension. He couldn't retire. So here you got a guy in his 70s out there working on a garbage truck. Not, you know, look, I spent a couple of years on the back of a Packer. It is not easy work. In fact, best shape I was ever in is back when I was playing football. That, you know, that was, you know, it was the best workout you could get. Definitely not something you're going to do in your 70s, though. And tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with someone from United for a Fair Economy. They're coming out with their 11th annual Martin Luther King Day report titled State of the Dream 2014, Healthcare for Whom? Enduring Racial Disparities. And, you know, look, part of what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to do and hopefully will do, will end those divides. And while I see them on lines of poverty, I can see how you can make it on race as well. There are huge disparities in wealth between the races, between whites and blacks, Hispanics. But to me, it all comes back down to all people in poverty. And I really think that's where King was at. It's about raising up all of the folks in poverty so that they all had opportunity and a job and health care. So tomorrow we're going to take a look at that because I think it's important that we realize. I hear an awful lot of this message, and I do this stupid thing, and I know I shouldn't, but you get into some of these articles online that, you know, that talk about racial inequality and they talk about economic inequality, and then you got these nitwits who are, you know, they're making the right wing arguments, which are generally dumb, and I get caught up in reading the comments, and I know I shouldn't. I know it's an exercise in futility, but I do, and it's the one that caught me today was, you know, this view that our social programs, our safety net programs that understand saved us from a Great Depression, are somehow a total socialism, and we're now a socialist nation, and nobody has any incentive to work, which is ridiculous. But you know, you get caught up in this frame of mind of trying to fight back, and it just, you're never going to do it. You've got these people who their minds are set on this idea that if there's anyone behind them on the socioeconomic ladder, it's somehow their fault. And I looked at the numbers that I talked about the other night that the Bloomberg Billionaire Index pointed out, that you've got the 300 richest people in this world who added another $524 billion to their fortune. Over 16% increase in their wealth, while the rest of the world and here in the U.S. fell behind. And we're told repeatedly, sorry, we don't have the ability to fund health care for everyone. We don't have the ability to make sure that everyone gets a good education. We don't have the resources to invest and create jobs. And that's what's really, really, really angering. Because you see this wealth, you see them flaunt this wealth, especially on these reality TV shows. It just, it's... you know, just misery porn, I guess, at this point. And you look at this and you go, you know, there are alternatives. There are things we can be doing, but there are folks who keep telling us we're helpless. We're helpless without them. You know, I still love that History Channel series, The Men Who Built America. You know, like the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and those, they were out there with their hammer and their saw building things. They basically took tax money, took money from the government, and used it for their own aims, and then treated people horribly. You know, I think of a Mother Jones quote quite often. When she met a guy who was in jail, she asked him, you know, what are you in jail for? And he said, well, I stole a pair of shoes so I could go to work. And she said, well, that was your problem. You stole shoes to go to work. You should have stole the railroad. This way we would have made you a robber baron. And this way you'd have been one of the wealthy elites and you wouldn't have been in jail. And, you know, I think of that occasionally because I remember back, and I can go, when I was younger, I had some scrapes with the law. And I remember going into court, and we used to go to court when I was younger just to watch other people's misery. And I remember, you know, seeing these people coming in, one woman in particular who stole, like, I think it was like $40 or $50 worth of food. And because she was trying to feed her two kids, didn't have the money. And is it right? Am I advocating for people to go steal food? No, but do I understand? Yes. When you don't have it, when you're desperate, you're going to get it one way or another. And I remember that they sent this woman to jail for an entire year. I guess it was like her third offense, though, of stealing food. And you think back to this and you go, what kind of a civil society would spend $30,000, $40,000 a year to lock somebody up for stealing $30 worth of food? And I look at the push towards ending, you know, unemployment insurance and the push towards getting rid of food stamps and all of the safety net programs that we've got in place. And I go back to this idea that, you know, is this where we're heading? To where, sorry, you couldn't feed your family, we've got to lock you up. And then what happens to the kids? I mean, you know, in remembering that, you know, walk through that for a second. You know, here's someone who, you know, in fact, you know, here just recently, came across a friend who knows somebody who over Christmas got caught stealing something for their child for Christmas. Didn't have the, you know, the 15 or 20 bucks. Now she's facing, you know, upwards of, you know, 3 to 4 years in jail. What happens to the kid if she gets locked up? All because couldn't get a job. All because, and this is the other part, a huge part of this, we have cut funding for mental health services, who this woman desperately needed. Cut her off. So because we've stopped investing in mental health programs and stopped, you know, making sure that people have enough to put on the food to put on the table, now you've got a situation where probably going to lock this woman up for some time. What happens to that kid? You're talking about $30,000, $40,000 a year to lock somebody up in prison. And then the care of this child, what happens? I think we, as a focus in our politics, are so hell-bent on punishment, on retribution, on pointing the finger downward, that we've lost our freaking minds, that we've lost common sense. Now, can we have a society where no one works? Obviously not. But I'm telling you, we wouldn't have that anyway. You know, I'm often told that we're this grand Christian nation, compassionate. I remember George W. Bush came in, talking about compassionate conservatism. Like that was ever going to happen. And I remember thinking, you know, every year of his budget, of which Tom Corbett's going to be giving his budget speech here in the next couple of weeks. I can't wait for that. But every year of the Bush budget, he wanted to repeal the supplemental nutrition food program. And what this program was is it gave seniors, low-income seniors, a bag of fresh produce, actual food, healthy food. And it was a very minimal, like $40 million program nationwide. I mean, really very minimal. But every year that was out of his budget. And to me, that really sent a message in bold neon lights that was the priority that this guy had. Sorry, Granny, you're on your own. And that's the message that I'm getting from the current crop of little W's. You're on your own. We don't care about you. And if you get caught stealing food to put on the table, our prison industrial complex will be very happy. Just seems odd to me. Just seems in the wrong direction. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Infrastructure investment and jobs will be high priorities for the AFL-CIO in 2014. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the U.S. has a $3.6 trillion infrastructure deficit. The amount of money needed to adequately repair, restore, and upgrade America's infrastructure to remain globally competitive.
What would work best to grow our economy is a comprehensive strategy to invest in infrastructure and energy innovation. And I'm talking about measuring our investment in trillions with a T, a big investment to create jobs and spur our economy.
Trumka says he'll be listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech to judge the commitment to domestic policies that will help working people.
To make meaningful gains possible in the lives of typical working families. I want to hear about increases in the minimum wage, proposals for sick leave to help families and other measures to boost living standards, to help rebuild a strong middle class, and to stop the collapse of wages for working families.
Trumka says we can't let the ideological opposition of some Republicans derail public infrastructure investments. The AFL-CIO will try to partner with groups like the Chamber of Commerce to get infrastructure investments that would create badly needed jobs.
The Chamber and the AFL-CIO agree that the country's atrophying, that we need to meet the deficit that the Society of Civil Engineers places at $3.6 trillion. If you care about this country, if you care about the competitiveness of this country, we can't allow ideology to stop us from doing what's necessary to keep the American economy competitive and keep people working.
A new 5-year national contract will be implemented for 13,000 UPS freight workers represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The workers voted overwhelmingly to approve the contract. It includes a $2.50 per hour raise over the 5-year deal, making Teamster UPS workers the highest paid in the industry, according to the union. The union says the new contract also improves and protects pension benefits, lowers health insurance copays while maintaining strong benefits, provides the ability for more part-time workers to become full-time, and lowers the monthly
cost for retiree health insurance. Every day that Republicans in Congress refuse to act to extend unemployment benefits, millions of dollars are lost to the economy, and long-term jobless workers grow increasingly desperate. Maura Stamper of Southgate, Michigan, was forced off unemployment benefits just before Christmas.
And if I wasn't married, I'd be on the street. I know there's lots of people that are on the street. And if this continues, we could very well lose our house that we've been in for 25 years. I just don't know how much more I can stress that we need these benefits. We need these benefits to survive, not to get rich, just to survive.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Great news today, though. My daughter made the all-star basketball team. Very proud, very happy, very happy for her. Congratulations to her, and just a great day. Anyway, let's get some real news from around the country, Washington, D.C., all around the world. Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you so much.
So I understand the White House is responding to the NSA article in the New York Times today.
Yes, they certainly did. And basically they said, the NSA has not collected data on Americans who are living in this country, but they do this in terms of drug trafficking, human trafficking, and the kinds of issues that we're all concerned about in terms of terrorism. But they didn't say that they weren't going to stop, were they? And they also said they didn't spy on foreign governments.
All right. As I was reading that article this morning, you know, it was one of those moments where you go, is anyone surprised? I mean, isn't this stuff we already knew?
Yes. It is a lot of stuff that we already knew. I think we didn't know that you could get things by wire, right?
Right.
And radio waves, which is what they did get.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the technology that that the Times says we have. I'm pretty impressed by it.
We wonder what your tax dollars at work.
So then
they're not doing unemployment.
There you go.
But they're certainly doing this.
They're not creating mass number of jobs. Maybe a couple high tech jobs here, but I'm looking at this and I'm going, this is something that the article pointed out started back in 2008. Before Obama took office. And this is one of those institutional moves. You can blame him if you want, but, this is part of the whole institutional, the military-industrial complex moving in that direction.
Yes. I mean, and that is certainly a problem because, although I have to tell you, the president did talk today about creating manufacturing zones, and he's going to be obviously talking about that at State of the Union. He talked about it in North Carolina today. So that was good news, but there needs to be a lot more of that and a whole lot less of our money spent by NSA funds.
Now, what I'd like to know is I would like to know what the details of the manufacturing zones are. Are these where we're going to give huge amounts of tax dollars, massive tax breaks? And, don't worry about those pesky laws. We'll exempt you from all of those things. Just bring back, mechanized manufacturing back to the U.S.
That's exactly right.
Because, at this very time, I guess tomorrow morning they're going to have a hearing. The Senate Finance Committee is going to have the hearing on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. And to me, from top to bottom, everything I've heard about this is horrible for people who work for a living. It's good for if you're an investor, especially if you're an institutional global investor, you're aces. Everybody else, I think we're all screwed in this.
Let's hope not.
Right.
But it could be.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. What I do know is this president said he was going to be the most transparent president in history. There'd be more transparency. Yet only 600 people got to see the negotiations, the trade advisors or corporate lobbyists, however you want to identify them. Those are the people who were allowed to work on this. Even Alan Grayson, who said he has seen the agreement but can't tell anybody what's in it, seems to me to be the antithesis of the most transparent ever.
Well, what we always say, honestly, is that the president's, this is what we say at the White House press room. The president who says, I am not going to nation build, that's Bush. Nations build.
Right.
I'm going to be the most ethical president ever. That's Clinton. You know what he did. We're going to be the most transparent nation, administration. We always say they do the opposite of what they say they're going to do.
Point made. Point made. So will Governor Brown run for the top office in 2016?
No, he is not. He has run for office three times as president. He's 75 years old, Jerry Brown, if you can believe it. And he says he's not running.
Yeah, he's been around forever. I mean, he ran, you know, back in 88, didn't he?
Yes.
Maybe even before that, I think.
76, I think, was his first time.
But I remember him in 88, and he actually had some pretty good ideas. One of them...
He does have good ideas, but he's... I've seen him when he was a talk show host, and I got to tell you, he's a bit arrogant. He's a good governor, but he's a bit arrogant.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, in order to do that kind of a job, you got to have a little bit, of tough skin, I would think, especially with everybody taking shots at you. But one of the ideas I thought was fantastic that he had back in the 80s was we need to rewire the country. Had we done that, you know, some of our energy problems would have lessened because, you know, you read some of these stories where, you know, a huge amount of our energy is lost just in transmission lines because they're so old. You know, maybe have that kind of stimulus spending to go, you know what, we're going to train a bunch of electricians and we're going to go around the country, we're going to rewire things.
Right.
Awesome.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, there's infrastructure issues, as you know. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could bring back all of this.
You just have to have the political will.
Right.
And we really don't. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in Pennsylvania where the vast majority of people I know don't care about privatizing the liquor stores. They don't care about attacking workers' rights. They don't want to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. All of the things that the Republicans here in our state are pursuing are all things nobody wants other than the huge money interest. And what you find, you hang around the game long enough, is, you know, what the people want seem to be damned. It's what the contributors of the campaign really want.
Well, I think that, you know, when people are politicians, they may start out with lofty goals, and they quickly, the system ruins them.
Good point. So the manufacturing speech today, what outside of these manufacturing zones, what other details did he give?
Well, we don't really have any. We do know that they're going to start, I think, at least three places. And my guess is that this is going to be, again, we're going to hear a lot about this in the State of the Union. This is kind of his rollout for that.
Now, where are any idea where the three places are or didn't?
I do, and it's escaped me, but obviously one is in North Carolina.
All right. Well, obviously, because he wouldn't have given the speech there. A state, which I got to be honest, I have no idea why he, with all of the insanity that's gone on there, why he would pick that as the place to prop up. I'm not.
Well, and it's interesting because the woman who is running for office, Senator Kay Hagan, didn't show up at a speech day. Now, there is Senate business going on.
Right.
But normally she would have hopped the plane with him and hopped back.
Yeah, the guy running against her in the Senate race, because she's being challenged from a Tea Party guy, I guess a couple of people, but one of the Tea Party people running against her said, you know, those food stamps, that's slavery. Shouldn't give those. They're just slaves. Just make some slaves to the food stamps.
Yeah, like anybody... wouldn't want a well-paying job where they can get some self-respect.
Yeah, and he claims, you know, he calls himself a self-described wacko bird. Said he moved to North Carolina because he so admired Jesse Helms. I said, well, there you go. A challenge to Obamacare rejected by the D.C. Circuit Court?
Yes, it was rejected by the D.C. Circuit Court. It had something to do, and I don't really understand it, but it has something to do with tax credits. So that you don't get federal tax credits, you do get some state tax credits in the state exchanges. They said that this was an unfair ruling, unconstitutional, and basically the judge said it's a lousy argument and threw the case out.
Is there a point at which, do you think we're there yet, where we finally just are done with these lawsuits and they come up and they get thrown out?
A lot of people think this is one of the last ones.
Good, good.
No, I mean, they'll appeal it, but you know what.
Yeah. understand Jay Carney in the White House, something on Iran?
Yes. Well, as you know, the president's under a lot of pressure because he wants to give some sanctions to Iran. And he wants to lift some sanctions with Iran. Members of Congress don't want him to do that. And today, Jay Carney sent a little message out to them via the press saying, nothing is off the table, meaning we will deal with this. And don't worry, the president can be tough.
And there was a horrible bombing in Iraq, I understand?
Yes, there were actually a series of bombings, and I think one took place in a market, and 56, something like that, people were killed.
Wow.
It's just awful.
You know, the congressman in this area where I live, he's been pounding the Iraq drum, and I've been thinking, you know, this is the game, this is the message change, because the Republicans have been getting beat up so badly on the poverty message, because they have no message, they have no policies, they have nothing other than you know, demonizing and retribution and payback as policy, that they got to change the message somehow. So I'm looking at this stuff in Iraq, and I'm going, yep, that's where they're going.
Right. And that is where they're going. And I think that you've got, I just had dinner with somebody who shall remain nameless and told me, listen, the other problem in Iraq is George Bush made this war and the Chinese are getting the oil.
Yep. Well, you knew that almost from the beginning. I mean, that happened during the Bush years where they signed those contracts.
Right. And we didn't even get the oil out of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and you know, we set it up
and
as
a destabilized country.
Right, and we set it up as a conservative paradise where, you know, corporations can expatriate all their profits and not be taxed. And, you know, they made labor unions illegal. They did all of the things that conservatives would just, you know, all wet in the panties about, but it hasn't seemed to really turn around all that much.
Right.
Yeah, just
crazy.
It is crazy. I guess we're pledging some money, more money to Syria?
Well, a lot of countries are pledging more money to Syria. The problem is that they couldn't collect it all last time. So people pledge money at these pledge conferences, usually run by the United Nations, and then people don't come up with the cash.
Yeah, you got to hate when that happens. I've run charity drives where that happens, where you get a bunch of people who, oh, yeah, I'll give you, you know, this or that, and that never comes through. What's going on in South Sudan? I know you're intimately involved.
Oh, my
there.
Gosh. It's really a mess. We know that Uganda is bringing planes over. They're supporting President Kiir, but that is not going to help the civil war in that country, honestly. The NUARs, Uganda people are bombing, they have control of the oil fields. It's a mess.
That is a mess. Are you going back there anytime soon?
I am, but I'm not saying when.
Ellen, come on.
I'll tell you when I see you next week.
Uh-oh. Well, you're a braver woman than I am. In the middle of a civil war, you're going to go traipsing into the middle of it. I give you credit.
Well, I'm insane.
We all have.
But the area I'm going to is safe. If it isn't safe, I don't go.
Okay, good. That's what I wanted to know.
As my friend Jim Pinkerton said, medicine and goats are no match for an AK-47.
This is the absolute truth. And finally, the Israeli defense minister has apologized. What over?
Well, he apparently has said that John Kerry should take his Nobel Prize, if of course he doesn't have one, and go home and leave them alone. But he apparently said that to a staff person. It was never meant to be public. There you have it.
Yeah,
he apologized.
And I'm sure Kerry accepted it graciously, much as it was, as he accepted it as it was meant.
Right. Exactly.
There you go. Ellen, always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You'll listen to the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In the ever-escalating competition to be the number one big-time college football program in the nation, Ohio State University bulked up last fall with a monster recruit named Max.
Actually, it's not the coaching staff that signed up this brute, but the OSU Campus Police Department. And the recruit's full name is Max Pro. Not a football player, but a 19-ton armored fighting vehicle built by a Pentagon contractor to withstand, quote, ballistic arms fire, minefields, IEDs, and nuclear, biological, and chemical environments. Wow, college games really have gotten rough. But the campus PD, which received the Max Pro as a gift from the Pentagon, i.e. us taxpayers, says it's not just playing games. Max is available for big actions, like hostage scenarios, killers loose on campus, and extreme flooding of up to 3 feet. Well, have such things been a problem at OSU? No. Would a huge, slow, gas-guzzling vehicle designed for warfare be effective if any of the above were actually to occur? No one in the department wanted to tackle that question. Oh, by the way, operating and maintaining these machines requires specially trained and licensed personnel. Are any of OSU's officers qualified? Again, no answer from headquarters. Also, the vehicles are subject to frequent rollovers, and they lack the ability to go off-road or to maneuver in confined areas. That doesn't sound ideal for a college campus. But the gendarmes say they've adjusted Max to fit their needs. How? By removing the gun turret and repainting the vehicle. This is Jim Hightower saying OSU police finally admitted that Max's chief role would be to provide a police presence on football game days. Great. Police authorities now believe they need a show of military force to keep tailgaters in check.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love?
Hug him, but don't hug him too closely. If you're married to him, be very careful, especially if you live in Virginia. Turns out, Mother Jones is reporting that State Senator Richard H. Black, who is running in for the congressional seat of the retiring Representative Frank Wolf, evidently, this is one of those moments where you just kind of go, what exactly were you thinking when you said that spousal rape isn't actual rape, it shouldn't be a crime? And when you said, well, you know, it can't possibly be a crime because the woman's sleeping in the same bed with you and she's in a nightie. You know, she was asking for it. She was sleeping and she had pajamas on. You know, come on, right? These are the people who are sitting in our halls of power. Or want to. This is scary stuff to me. These are the kind of people who make really bad decisions. Just a thought. The kind of people like in North Carolina. We talked a little bit yesterday about what they did to the unemployment compensation benefits by cutting the number of weeks from 26, which has been the standard across the country for years. But you understand, hey, look, it's going to take a little time, you know, get your resume together, you know, get out there and do some interviews, be maybe just a little bit choosy about the position you take because you're going to want a good fit. You don't want to jump at the first thing, end up being miserable and for crummy wages. Gee, that would just make for a plummeting standard of living for everyone. You want to be a little judicious at first, you know. Do a couple interviews. See what's out there. No, not North Carolina. Cut it down to 19 weeks and cut the benefit by nearly $200. So you go, well, what more could they do? Oh, well. Oh, boy. They've actually eliminated their earned income tax credit. And you go, what's that? The earned income tax credit was something created by conservative economists. All of the insane economic theory that the Republicans use came out of like the Chicago school mentality. Uncle Milton Friedman came up with a lot of this stuff. And what they've actually done is they've chosen the worst parts of his theory. They've taken the worst parts of it, and the parts that you go, well, might actually, maybe, could possibly work, they left that alone. Now, the earned income tax credit was one of those. And you go back to the Reagan years when they had increased it a little bit. He said that it was, if I remember the quote right, it was, you know, the best piece of pro-family, pro-worker legislation, and it's good for the country, and, it, you know, Congress finally did something that's going to help families. And now understand, this is the party of Reagan. Just to tell you how far we've gone from Reagan. And as insane as it was then, we have gone leaps and bounds beyond Reagan insanity. We're basically just free fall off the edge. In North Carolina, they've repealed the earned income tax credit. Now, understand what the earned income tax credit is. It's for people who work. In order to get this credit, you have to be working. One of the prerequisites for conservative ideology is you've got to be working or we're not going to help you. So these are folks who are low-income workforce. And what it's meant to do is say, okay, well, in North Carolina or in any state, here in Pennsylvania, same thing, what we're going to make sure is that everyone has a bare minimum amount of buying power. Because not only is it good for the families, it's good for the economy. Put money into the economy, it gets things going. And, you know, studies have shown, you know, in households where families get the earned income tax credit, they do much better than low-wage households that don't get it. Because you have a little bit better standard of living. Maybe you have a vegetable once every month. Maybe something. You know, just helps with a little nutrition. Helps. It helps. Well, they've done away with it, completely eliminated it. And, you know, one of a couple of states that have done this. What it actually means now is it means that North Carolina, by ending this, has raised the taxes of about 900,000 working households. Most of them households with children. Because, you know, that's one of the biggest recipients of the earned income tax credit are families, low-income families who have children. Because we've said, you know, hey, we want to make sure the kids get enough to eat. We want to make sure that they have a safe, secure place to put their head at night. You know, that kind of stuff. We used to think like that, but not so much. Now, understand, they're doing away with this program for the working poor. And, well, we know what they did. They gave huge tax cuts to the very well-to-do in the state. And how'd they pay for that? Well, one, by eliminating the help to 900,000 families there. They raised the state income tax, which will affect all working people, and disproportionately those at the bottom. They cut funding for schools. They cut funding for all of their other social services. Heck with them. And, of course, the unemployment, where they slashed benefits by $200 a week and knocked off, 7 weeks off of unemployment. Also, we could do what? Well, give more to the very wealthy. And doesn't that seem apropos? Doesn't it seem fitting? And you got to ask yourself, at what point do people say enough is enough already? Even small business owners. Because look, when you're pulling this kind of money out of the economy, when you're pulling this kind of cash out, it not only harms the people who are getting taken away, you're screwing the local businesses and you're slowing down your economy. Bad stuff. Simple. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Email me, rick@ricksmithshow.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Talk a little bit about liquor privatization, pollution, all kinds of stuff. Can't wait. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Thanks for being here.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway.